I have the great honor and pleasure now to introduce to you our guest from Aotearoa. Te Kamehau Hoskins is Pro Vice Chancellor Māori at the University of Auckland. Also, additionally, she holds many other important positions at this university. Since 2019, she is a Deputy Dean at the Faculty of Education and Social Work. Since 2017, she holds the position of Te Tumu, which means Dean Maori, at the Faculty of Education and Social Work. Also, she is Associate Professor at the Faculty of Education and Social Work in Te Puna Wananga School of Maori and Indigenous Education. She finished her PhD in 2010 on Maori and Levinas. And you can find outside the table outside a list of selected publications by Te Kamehau and Allison. I would like to hint at the article from 2012 by Te Kamehau, A Fine Risk: Ethics in Kaupapa Maori Politics, and also an article she published together with Allison in 2022, Indigenous Inclusion and Indigenizing the University, and most of all, the anthology, which was very important in my process to discover Kaupapa Māori from 2017, Critical Conversations in Kaupapa Māori. Allison Jones works as a professor at Te Puna Wananga School of Māori and Indigenous Education at the University of Auckland. She finished her PhD in 1987 on social reproduction in a New Zealand secondary school. Additionally to the already mentioned publications together with Te Kamehau Hoskins, I would like to hint at her book, which was published in 2020, This Pākehā Life, An Unsettled Memoir. And also I would like to welcome Deb Rariri, who luckily came to us too. Deb works as a neuroscience educator and is an activist in the field of Maori politics. She will not give a paper, but she will be with us and discuss with us. Welcome to you. We are very much looking forward to your session.
Oh, kia ora mai tātou katoa. Tēnei tū, hei tuku mihi atu ki te meninga. Kia koutou kua tatū mai nei rungi te kaupapa nui whakahirahira o te rā. He mihi hoki ki tēnei whenua, ki enei ngāhere, pango nei, i rongo nei mātou, ia mātou e tamariki ana i Aotearoa. Hoi anō he paku mihi tēnei kia koutou. Ka tuku hoki tētahi karakia hei paiterere o tō tātou noho i ngā rā i tēnei rā, i ngā rā e heke mai nei. Hoi anō, e whātoro atu ana te ngākau, kia rangi nui e tū nei, kia papatuanuku e takoto nei ki ngā pauwhare o ngā tūpuna, whakaaro nui ana ki ngā tāngata katoa i whakatō ki ai ko te ngākau marama, ki roto ki tēnā o tātou, e hāpai nei i nei mātauranga, hoi anō i te atorangi o papa, ko ia nei e rongo o whakairiake ki runga kia tīna, haumi e hui e, tae ki e.
Whakataka te hau ki te uru, whakataka te hau ki te tonga, kia makina kina ki uta, kia matara tara ki tai, e hia ke ana te atakura, he ti o, he uka, he hau, ti
Kia ora, everybody. We just started with some greetings to you and our indigenous language, Māori, which was really an acknowledgement of you all who have come to share this time together, an acknowledgement of your places and your ancestors and these and this black forest that we've been discussing, that in New Zealand we were raised on stories from the black forest and fairy tales from Germany. Very interesting. So it's astonishing to find ourselves here, really. And we just then also shared what we call a karakia, which is a prayer, but not a Christian prayer. It's really about intention and bringing our focus into flow for the next couple of days, and then finish with a waiata, which was a song, which was also a karakia, which is traditional to finish a little speech with a song. So, right. So I broke my laptop in about the, we've been here a month. I broke my laptop in the first week or two of my trip, so I have a little trusty notebook with my talk today. We are going to run it interactively. For the first maybe hour, because I think there's 2 hours. Surely you can't sit here for 2 hours. It'll have to be a break somewhere in the middle. But we usually just sort of speak to similar themes from different locations and share the time in that way, which we find more engaging for ourselves, but we hope also for you. And we may not take a full hour, but then I think we'd have a little break. And then we're really very interested in your questions and ideas and comments and thinking on this topic, because it's really difficult to come from our context, which is, you know, far away and deeply kind of, well, you know, New Zealand is so separate from the rest of the world in many ways and has a very particular history. And so our context is kind of everything to us. And so coming into your environment, into an international environment, it's very difficult to kind of read what it is you want to know or what it is you're thinking or in any of that stuff. So we would like that second hour to be mostly an hour of engagement, if that's okay with you. So I'm going to introduce myself and say a few things and then pass over to Alison. So it's important for me and Deb and Alison to say something about who we are. You know, we're not just brains walking around on a body. So I was born in a small town, not so small town, in north of Auckland, so the North Island of Aotearoa, New Zealand, and I was one of five siblings with a Māori dad and a Pākehā or European New Zealand mum. And my tribal groups are Ngāti Hau, which is the wind, and Ngāti Wai, which is the water, and Ngāti Hau, which is a term for a number of things, but for gathering together in the way that a net gathers things. In the colonial context of New Zealand, I actively pursued a Māori identity from an early age. It's a little bit of a question mark for me as to how and why that happened, because looking like this, I could have, you know, been half or, you know, ambiguously located. And so pursuing a Māori identity in a very racialized kind of world gave me some interesting insights from an early age, I think. And really, I think that happened because my mum was adopted and she had very little family, so my whole upbringing was kind of connected to my father's side and our tribal areas and our land. So I was raised in the context of the Renaissance, which is a really crap word, but I'm not sure we've got a better one. It's sort of the Renaissance of the Māori world, which was political, it was about land rights, it was about identity, it was about language, it was about tribal redevelopment. And my parents were sort of deeply involved in those settings, and so that was a big feature of my upbringing. So I feel like I've probably been grappling with these, you know, ideas about identity, settler-Indigenous relationships and so on from quite an early age. And then into an academic career, among other things, which, you know, is latterly anyway involved in, because I'm in a leadership role in the university, so it's in that project is really about indigenising the university. So a kind of a different project to simply a project about equity or equality, even though that's tied up in that, but it's about kind, and it's more than decolonising too. It's about, you know, how the university might embrace different priorities to the ones it values, and how it might do that even if it doesn't quite understand why those priorities might be of value to Māori and Indigenous communities. It's about the little things in the institution, and it's about the big things, structural things, power, but also, importantly, culture and relationships. So my work and our work is located in the context of the 1840 treaty, Te Tiriti o Waitangi, which you may or may not know about, which was, you know, the beginning of New Zealand as a nation state. And it was an agreement between the British Crown and Māori tribal collectives and leaders, in which the Indigenous Language Treaty, which was the treaty, that was the treaty that was signed by Māori, was in the Indigenous language, it was a draft in English, confirms Māori authority and provides British governance over their settlers in particular. So here we have this interesting emergence, if you like, of two forms of authority, different forms of authority at work in the one set of islands. And so I think our project has been from the beginning how these forms of authority can relate for the best outcomes for everybody in Aotearoa New Zealand. Of course, the British Crown and successive governments have assumed dominance, including the assumption that Māori forms of authority are subsumed within the unitary nation state. That's nothing new. But it's also probably important to note that for most Māori, particularly my own and Deb's tribal groupings, which is the area of the country where the treaty was signed, have always claimed that the treaty did not mean a cessation of sovereignty for us. And that's actually recently been backed up by the tribunal who is examining Māori claims related to the treaty. And so even though we recognise our relative marginalisation and poor social outcomes generally, we also don't always behave as colonised victims, and we also claim our sovereignty. So we have, it's not just a simple kind of positioning as the, you know, hapless victims of colonisation, if you like. And it's probably important to note too that Māori thinking and discourse is not, it's probably never really been, or maybe only for a moment in time, interested in tearing up that treaty or pushing Europeans into the ocean. That really hasn't been the approach. The approach has been to continue to call the coloniser into committed relationships with Māori, something like a marriage. It's a common metaphor. This is a marriage. How can this marriage be improved? How can we not divorce forever? Because really you can't divorce, can you, when you're sharing space? So just a couple more things. Alison and I, our relationship is framed by that history, the context, the politics, but also by Māori ontological approaches, which always prefer the relation, because it is here that productive outcomes are possible. This relationship of ours is framed in kin terms, kinship terms, or as a friendship. It is not only the relation of political ally and solidarity, which I think is a dominant way in which relationships between Indigenous and settler people are framed. There are aspects of aroha and or love and that attend our friendship. So I'm just reminded of Levinas there, who said, you know, what we are, you know, being a Māori, size, gender, woman, etc., doesn't exhaust all of who we are. We always exceed the what and the kind of social constructs. So we are friends, real friends. So we work together in the field, I guess, generally speaking, of Indigenous settler relations, which we aren't that happy with, but there doesn't seem to be much else to call it. And I'm interested in indigenising theory and practice. And the practice part is important, not simply because, you know, I'm in a leadership role, and so I'm all about the doing in the university, but it's also that our thinking and practice are really tightly connected and lived out and reflected on in the everyday context of what we do. In certain ways, we've become less theory-driven and less interested in abstract and universal ideas, which is not to say we don't like ideas, we love them. It's more to say that the political and the social relations and the face-to-face demands of our worlds is kind of all-embracing, it's kind of everything. So theory or ideas or critiques emerge in this way and are always relational, effective, political, embodied, and contextual. So I'm going to hand it over to you to say something.
Tēnā koe, te kawihau. Tēnā koutou katoa, ka nui te mihi ki a koutou, kua tai mai nei I tēnei ata. Greetings to you all. It's very nice to be here, meeting just about all of you for the first time. And I also want to greet Deb, our friend, who joined us this morning in our karakia and waiata. I'm just going to do a little bit of introduction to myself as well. And I'm going to try and sort of locate myself in three ways, mostly through my academic work, through my personal kind of location and my political location in Aotearoa, New Zealand. Somebody was just asking how long we'd been here, because it's kind of 24 hours on the plane to get here or more. We have, as Te Kawiho said, we have been here for a few weeks now. And one of the other reasons that we came to this part of the world was to visit Montpellier, where they, at the university there, they have an archive. And in that archive are a number of artefacts or taonga that were taken or collected by the French in 1824 from Deb's ancestors. And when Deb's, one of the elders from Deb's tribal group was hearing that we were coming here, he said, we want to find these things. And so we did find some objects, some beautiful things, and we visited them and greeted them in the archive at Montpellier. And it was a very moving experience for us, because we realised that no person from the country from which those taonga, those artefacts had come, had ever visited them in 200 years. And they went in 1824, so it's exactly just about 200 years. And the only people that had visited them were the curators and the people who cleaned the archive and the researchers from here, nobody from our country. So it was quite an important moment for us to feel what Māori termed the Māori, the spiritual essence of those objects that was still very much alive in those objects. So, and we came from there to here. So we've had quite an eventful time. Okay, so as Bettina said, I'm a professor in education working in the field of settler Indigenous relations. I came up through a science degree once upon a time through feminist theory, Marxist theory, critical theory, and into sociology of education in that kind of 80s, 90s way that many of us here did. And my most recent writing is in particularly focused on the relationship between Māori and non-Māori in the period before the treaty. The treaty, as Te Kauiho said, was in 1840 when British colonisers took power. But the period before that, there was 50 years of very interesting negotiation, travel by Māori overseas to England, to America, and particularly to Australia, in quite high-level political discussions. And so I've been very interested in tracking some of those relationships, which we look to now as kind of models of thinking about how we might relate, because they weren't constrained within the a colonial power framework. They were much more open, and Māori, as Te Kauiho said, were very active in seeking political, strategic political relationships with powerful others. So yes, I've been engaged in writing about that. And as Bettina said, I've also recently published a memoir which is about being a Pākehā. That word, which some of you may not have heard before, is a Māori word for a white person, particularly. It's a very ancient, it has ancient origins, and when Pākehā first arrived came over the horizon to Aotearoa New Zealand, particularly in 1769, when James Cook arrived, he was recognised as a Pākehā, or a word that's like that. At first, Māori thought that the white skin was a fairy figure from the Māori world, but luckily they had a Tahitian person on board the ship whose language was similar to Māori, and he could explain to Māori that these white-skinned people were of another world. They weren't of the Māori world. They weren't fairy figures from the Māori world. So I'm off a track. But interesting moments of recognition, forms of recognition, really interest me from that early period. The other thing mainly that I do, I work for Te Kauiho, and as I teach my colleagues, my academic and professional colleagues at the university about our history in Aotearoa New Zealand, I work alongside a Māori colleague to do that, and we help people in New Zealand be able to pronounce Māori words correctly, etc. So that's another lot of work that I do as part of my professorial role at the university. So that's just a general potted academic location. My personal location is I was born in New Zealand to English parents. Both of my parents are English, of English origin. I very much call myself a Pākehā, and we'll talk later in our session, I'm sure, about the notions of identity in relation to this kind of work. My mother's people played a significant or a specific role in the colonial history of Aotearoa, because in the 1860s there were significant wars by the British and by the settlers in New Zealand to forcibly remove land from Māori who were refusing to sell it. And my great-great uncles were officers in that two of those major wars in the Taranaki and the Waikato areas, where large quantities of land were forcibly taken or taken by confiscation in the 1860s. At the same time, another relation of mine in the same family was a politician who oversaw this decision to take Māori land. even though the agreement, as Te Kawiho said in 1840, was for Māori to maintain their own land and sell it only if they wished. But they did not wish. And as increasing numbers of Pākehā came, the demand for land increased, and so there was a forcible removal in the North Island, around where we live, that was quite significant. And lastly, in terms of my kind of political location, Te Kawiho talked about the Treaty of Waitangi, which was an agreement in 1840 between the British Crown and the Māori hapū, or the Māori tribal leaders, to British, the British coming and setting up forms of governance for their own people, so they could come and govern their own people, but not govern Māori. That was the agreement. But the British Crown, in their version of this particular treaty, said, this says you have agreed to cede your power to us, the sovereignty to us. So they claimed complete power over a period of time. Now, the treaty has become, it isn't just forgotten, it has become the basis of nearly all our state institutions. So what's interesting, maybe interesting to you, that education, health, law, all of those major state institutions have very, very clear statements about the Treaty of Waitangi, which is reminding us that we must operate in a way that is more like a partnership than a colonial structure. And so that demand actually comes to us from the state. It's usually us pushing back against the state, but quite interestingly in New Zealand, the state, for all the limitations, we can critique these things, but there is a constant kind of pressure or push or an eye on us, all the institutions, to keep this in mind. I don't think it's because the governments think the treaty is such a wonderful thing. I think it is because we are very conscious that our social statistics in New Zealand, as far as Māori are concerned, remain poor after all these years. And this is seen recognising the treaty and engaging in a more realistic partnership, if you like to call it that, is going to lead to better outcomes than the previous models, which were the equity, diversity, inclusion models. And Kawiho and I are working on those kinds of things in the university. We can talk about those a bit later.
So we were partly asked to speak about kaupapa Māori, or we actually put that forward. And I don't know how many of you have heard about kaupapa Māori, or kaupapa Māori theory. But basically, I guess it's local indigenous theory to Aotearoa New Zealand. It emerged in the context of, obviously, the Māori cultural, social, political renaissance, and in particular in the context of schooling and education and critiques of Western schooling and education and the kind of experiences that Māori students were having and are continuing to have in New Zealand schools. So loss of language, obviously, but, you know, the whole project of assimilation was central to the establishment of schooling in New Zealand, and that the whole idea, even though it was termed different things over a period of time, from outright assimilation, the use of schooling to assimilate Māori, to terms like integration, where little aspects of Māori culture might be retained to aid the assimilation, and so on. These are basically the effects of schooling in New Zealand were aimed at Māori assimilation. And so, in this, probably starting in the late 60s, but gaining real energy in the 70s and 80s, we saw demands for education in the Māori language and Māori schooling options shaped and governed by Māori, including Māori preferences for pedagogy and curriculum, and which led over time and with much struggle to a schooling type called kura kaupapa Māori. And kura means school, and kaupapa Māori means basically, I guess together, means Māori philosophy schools, schools grounded in Māori ontology, if you like, and epistemology, which wasn't, you know, a rejection, an entire direction of the curriculum, but it was certainly bringing Māori concepts, values and knowledges into engagement with the existing New Zealand curriculum. So you can think of the kaupapa part of kaupapa Māori as philosophy, as principles, as foundations. There's lots of many, many uses of that term. So colleagues of Alison's actually, no, actually maybe students of Alison's at Auckland University in the School of Education, namely Graham Hingaroa Smith, who you may have come across, and you probably have heard of Linda Tuhiwai Smith. They were colleagues of Alison's, lecturers of, and supervisors of me, started to develop this idea from schooling that they had been involved in kura kaupapa Māori schooling, started to develop that theoretically within the academy, within the university. So this was about making, you know, theoretical space within the academy for Indigenous and Māori thinking. So it was a strategic strategy on behalf of Graham in particular, and Alison can talk more about that because she was there then. So as Graham, you know, Graham Smith is really, in a sense, the architect of kaupapa Māori, and he has always conceptualised it as a cultural project, which obviously includes, you know, ontology, epistemology, Indigenous thought, and a political project about structural, you know, about structural, you know, about power, structural relationships, and so on. So from the start, kaupapa Māori has been distinguished from other terms in use in New Zealand, such as mātauranga Māori, which is concerned specifically with Māori knowledge systems. And so kaupapa Māori has always had this political dimension, and that political dimension in Graham's work in particular, and then in the work of many of our students ourselves and many of our students who have taken up kaupapa Māori in their research and in their methodology and in their theorising, has been grounded in, broadly speaking, critical theory and the critical theory of the Frankfurt School and of Habermas and others. So interesting synergies going on here. And in particular, interest in, you know, critiques of power, the way ideology works to, you know, hegemony and all of these kinds of concepts, which you can see how useful those concepts would be and are for marginalised Indigenous communities. What else? Yeah, I mean, I don't think that many, if any, scholars, Māori scholars in New Zealand have dug very, very deeply into the Frankfurt School and the different theorists within that. But generally, that's the kind of genealogy of the development, if you like, of those ideas. And I think the other thing about critical theory that really attracted Graham in particular was, you know, the idea that this is not just a critique, this is about action, this is about activism, this is about making a stance, not just sort of, you know, theory on high, if you like. And I've, in my time, have come to have some critiques of critical theory and the kaupapa Māori utilisation of critical theory, because I've come to think that while it has offered really powerful kind of oppositional stances and critiques with useful effects, it's created spaces for Māori activity, the development of Māori institutions, also educational approaches and so on, and forms of political and other recognition, and it remains a useful sort of approach. But it also has had the effect of focusing, I believe, our attention, our Māori attention, too much on the coloniser, too much on, you know, so re-centering the coloniser and everything we're doing, always thinking about and being annoyed with and angry with and speaking back to the coloniser and writing about this a lot. And not so much thinking about, okay, what can we draw from our own contemporary and historical political practice as Māori communities? What does that look like? And if you look at that, it looks a lot different to critical theory. It's less interested in oppositional, combative, binary stances and power, you know, power analyses, and much more interested in the relationship, even in the face of unequal power relationships, and even where there's a significant risk associated with engagement and relating. So I'm just trying to, I guess, work into that space. Look at all the ways in which we ourselves, Māori, overlook our wonderful, rich set of political practices which are really grounded in the day-to-day engagement with others in face-to-face relationships. They were in the past and they are now. There's a remarkable, despite colonisation, a remarkable continuity of practice among our people. And we don't even see it ourselves, and sometimes we don't value it ourselves. So I think for us, there's a lot that we can do, a lot of work we can do theoretically to bring that to our own attention and potentially to the attention of others. So yeah, we've been overlooking our considerable powers and the many ways in which we are not victims, but have rich ways of thinking, being and doing. So my attention is focused more here in considering Māori and Indigenous approaches to the political. I'm just repeating myself, so I'm just going to go on. I suppose I wanted to, because I'm not going to speak a long time on kaupapa Māori, but because there's so much you could say, but really, we can't escape the relation because, you know, we live the world as a sort of vast webs of dynamic kin relationships. Some are closer, some are further afield. But in the end, ultimately, you know, this is idea of the universe and the world is a set of kin relationships. So we are always already in relationship, you know, even when that relationship is gone bad. So there's always a possibility of return to productive cycles of relationship. And that's what I think we're always trying to do. That seems to me what we're always trying to do. And that's what any of us can do. You know, that's what we can put our emphasis there. And why? Why would we look for positive cycles of engagement? Because we're about maximising life. You know, maximising life. It's simple, I think. We're all interested in that, aren't we? Yeah, so as I think I've said, Indigenous settler relationships, despite unequal relations of power, Māori will always risk engagement and take the relational route. And I think that's my main message for thinking about kaupapa for you, for thinking about kaupapa Māori and what it might offer. There's much more that can be said about knowledge, the way in which certain knowledges can only really be produced in context, in the specific context of relationships, in the specific context of place, in the specific context of human, non-human relationships. You know, and that knowledge can't easily be decontextualized and put to work in another place. And I think these are some of the significant considerations we and you will have in your, you know, approaching Indigenous theory. Shall I pass it back to you?
So in relation to what Te Kauiho has said, being alongside her and Linda Smith and Graham Smith in the development of kaupapa Māori, Māori philosophy, a kind of concept that could take be recognised within the academy, whereas before we were using the language of critical theory, here was a Māori term that was for Māori, by Māori, and claimed by Māori very actively within the academy. The question then becomes, okay, for a person like me, where does that leave me? And for many of you, as European, as white, as colonisers, as settler peoples, however you want to understand your own history, how do we have a relationship with kaupapa Māori? And of course, it's different for you having a relationship with kaupapa Māori than it is for me, who is right there in that place, in those interpersonal and political relationships on a daily basis. And so the questions that you might have in your minds and that were raised by Bettina in her abstract for the conference are very much what is in it for the West. I mean, how can the West relate to Indigenous theory? And those of us who have Western origins living in New Zealand, these are the questions that remain for us as well. They're not just for the outside. The fact that in Aotearoa New Zealand, there is this identity position, Pākehā, which people like me can take up and inhabit, means that that identity puts me automatically in relation to the Māori world or Māori individuals or Māori politics. I already have a relationship with that, and that helps form who I am, not just my politics in my head, but culturally in my being. And so as a Pākehā, it's not that I'm saying I'm a pretend Māori, I speak some Māori and I have some practices that are affected by Māori cultural practices. It's not that I'm trying to be like Māori, I am being fully Pākehā. I'm being fully my white self within this relationship. Does that make sense? But that's very different for you because you're not within, in the same obvious way that we are in New Zealand, an ongoing colonising, decolonising, indigenising, and all those things are happening at once situation. So your relationship with this kind of work is different. And what interests me is, I don't know whether many of you are involved in whiteness studies, but I know particularly in the US and the UK, many of those of us who are doing this kind of work understand work in the area of whiteness and whiteness studies, and that's a kind of position or a discourse that I have never found attractive, because to me it doesn't provide me with an identity position. It's not relational. The idea of whiteness is not relational. Whereas a Pākehā identity is very much, by definition, a relational position. Now, that's not to say that I ignore arguments about race and racism, because they are integral to all this. But in the context of Aotearoa New Zealand, whiteness, just the whole discourse of whiteness, seems to be imported from the UK and the US, where we're very good at importing foreign ideas, and takes us away from that, the relational possibilities that exist in the identity of Pākehā that are both historical and current and very present and demanding. The other, and Te Kauiho has touched on this just before as well, the other discourse that is taken up by people in my sort of situation and maybe yours is the idea of ally or allyship. You've heard this? Yeah. So that is very popular in New Zealand as well, being an ally. And again, I personally don't find this a useful discourse for the work I do. I think I'm touching on what Te Kawiho was saying before, that an ally, again, doesn't have a sense of duality, like I'm an ally to you. It seems more one way, whereas if I'm trying to dig around for a word in English that works, I can only come down to friendship, whatever is contained in the idea of friendship, which is has a mutuality to it, has emotion to it, and also holds the possibility of difficulty. And to Kawiho's and my relationship, we have a personal friendship, but also politically that relationship can sometimes be quite tense and difficult because of the ways that politics operate within the institution, who can speak about what and when. And so we are conscious that we are operating within those political as well as those personal identities. And when I mentioned my relationship to kaupapa Māori before, and I said it was for Māori, by Māori, that was the slogan, I personally have been challenged quite vociferously about being a Pākehā working in relation to kaupapa Māori. Stay out, this is our space. And I understand that argument, but I continue through a series of friendships I have and quite deep, long-standing relationships. And it's those that enable the work, the partnership, if you like, the friendship, the political work that I do. So it isn't simply the question of solidarity. I don't just stand in solidarity, because solidarity can be theory-based and distanced, which is fine. For many of us, solidarity is the only position we can take that's only available to us. But when you're working within a political context, more is demanded of you than solidarity, whether it's money right through to tears from the body, the mind, every part. And that can be very, very difficult, very, very difficult. And one of the messages that I'm constantly trying to get across to my colleagues in New Zealand who are working, trying to work similarly to me, perhaps, is to say you have to become more comfortable with discomfort. You have to be able to take it. Because for many of us, if a Māori person criticises us, we will run away and say, I'm never going to work with Māori again, it's too hard. Too hard, too complicated, too difficult, too slow. And so I'm going to go and do something else over here. I understand that. But if we're going to remain in that marriage, in that relationship, we've just got to keep coming back, as Te Kawiho says, the return, the constant return, the turning towards. And we just have to keep doing it, regardless. It doesn't mean to say that you ignore criticism or that you're whakahihi, that you're, you know, don't you criticise me, but it's a humble return. It's a constant return. And I know I often make mistakes. I say things that are stupid, that are colonising, that, you know, but it's just a matter of continuing to take those steps forward. And I can only do that because of my relationships. And that's, you know, that's where the personal and the political get deeply entangled. Because I know that if Te Kawiho or Deb say to me, mm-mm, Alison, stepped too far, and that sometimes happens, I know, okay, I take that. I learn from that. And I think about who I am in this relationship. So those are all the kind of complex aspects of the idea of allyship and whiteness that I find, for me personally, problematic. Now, that doesn't mean to say that they are the same, there are the same set of problems for all of you who are working in very different political relationships to Indigenous theory and Indigenous knowledges. I'm quite conscious that we've reached an hour, and you have been very patient and quiet, so maybe we should just take a little break. what we would like to happen, if you could just take a break for a cup of tea or whatever, and maybe it would be good if we could start a bit of a conversation. So maybe when you come back, you can get into groups of about three, just have a wee conversation to come up with some questions, comments, that we can continue this conversation at a level and at a rate that interests you. Because here we are speaking at you, we don't know you, and so we would like to be able to have more of a two-way engagement. And the other thing, before we do that, we also need to remind you that Te Kauiho and myself do a lot of this kind of work together, and neither of us are touchy. So we are open. We will not worry about any question you ask. So don't feel shy or embarrassed to ask any question. It might be naive, but that's all right. We're very happy with any question you want to ask us. So can you take a break for a few minutes? And then, sorry. Yeah, and then we'll come back, have a little talk, and then we'll come back in the big conversation. Kia ora, thank you.